And I will now introduce tonight's panel to discuss this important book. And here it is. I hope you can see it. It's called The Wake Up Call: Why the Pandemic Has Exposed the Weakness of the West and How to Fix It. It's an important and timely book in the week when the official number of deaths from COVID in the UK passed 100,000. One of the highest, if not the highest, per capita score in the world. To kick off, we have the book's two authors, John Micklethwaite and Adrian Wooldridge. John was editor-in-chief of The Economist for 10 years and is now editor-in-chief of Bloomberg News, while Adrian is political editor of The Economist and author of their Badgett column. And then to respond to the ideas in the book, we have Philip Rycroft, former permanent secretary in DEXU, the Department for Exiting the European Union. And before that, he was second permanent secretary in the Cabinet Office and head of the UK Governance Group. In his active retirement, he holds a number of honorary positions, including being a visiting professor at Edinburgh University. So that's our panel. Each of our speakers is going to talk for just 5 minutes at the start, and we'll then have a panel discussion for 30 minutes or so before we open it up to Q&A. Abby Turner is going to collect and then collate the questions. If you want to ask your question direct, we'll ask you to unmute. But if you want Abby to put your question, that's fine. And please be understanding if your question's not selected, we may not be able to answer them all. The seminar will end at the latest by 7:15. So let me now invite my first speaker, John Micklethwaite, to introduce the book. John, over to you.
Well, thank you very much, Robert, and thank you very much, Philip, for being here. And apologies, I was the one why we were started slightly late. The basic reason why we wrote this book, there are two sort of big themes throughout it. The first was really simple, was the idea that government matters. What we think is that this crisis, COVID, exposed the sort of weakness of the West, and particularly the idea that government mattered. That we got used, and both Adrian and I come originally from The Economist, one of the great apostles of the free market and the private sector, but this was a crisis where the efficacy of the public sector really mattered, where good government was, in a sense, the difference between living and dying, and government really does make a difference. And the simplest way to look and understand that is just to look at the number of deaths per million people. And I checked yesterday, and the numbers roughly are, in Britain, sadly, we are over 1,500 deaths for every million people. In America, the number is above 1,300. But if you go to the countries of Asia, you find numbers which are around 40, 50. These are places like Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and so on. And you have China down at 3, which I'll come back to in a second. You find places like Germany, which are up around 600. You find some countries that have done really rather well, like Greece, which have outperformed. But what's interesting about this general table is it matches other tables that we've seen for things like education, healthcare, and so on. And it shows that government now, it's not a fluke, I think, really, when you look at that list of people. It's the same list of people coming at the top. And the reason why, they're countries that are focused on government, and we will come back to this, no doubt, but we stress that virtually all of them are democracies. Virtually all of them are ones that have really started to think about government in a much more serious way. And what's striking to us is that you have, in this particular scenario, you have governments that have outperformed each other by enormous margins. In the private sector, if another company was 10% better than you, you'd probably go out of business. The sort of numbers we're talking about here, people are 20, 30, 40, 50 times better than other ones. And governments have been remarkably slow at copying it. So one factor was just to say, we think government matters, and that people, especially in the West, should re-examine the issue of government. The second issue goes back to that number to do with China, and Adrian's going to come on and talk about the history in a second. But a number of 3 for China against a number of over 1,500 for America, to us, argues for something much bigger happening in geopolitics. Now, that number of 3, we can go back and examine and question. And most of us, I think the Chinese are hiding some deaths. But I think I probably employ more foreign journalists in China than anybody else. I think we would, if we said that they were hiding 9 out of 10 deaths, most people would say it's way less than that, because we live and see the big cities where they operate. But all the same, imagine for the sake of argument that China's real number is around 30. That would still put it at 40 times better than America. And that is a real challenge, a real change in the way that you look at the world. And what is happening in China is not, we would argue, entirely due to authoritarian, but at the very least is putting a challenge towards the West and the democracies. The Chinese are picking up, they're picking up on a model of good government that began in Singapore, and they are consciously copying, and so is much of Asia. Now, I'll end with just one simple thing. I think one sort of canard we have to sort of shoot down, and which has been the great excuse of our leaders, is the idea that this is something to do with freedom. Virtually everything you do to do with COVID is to do with efficiency rather than particularly that. If you want the easiest example of it, look at the difference between Seoul and London and New York. They're all huge metropolises, roughly the same size. Well, New York has sadly lost well over 20,000 people. London, last time I checked, is well over 6,000. Seoul is around about 100 people. Now, when you think about that, Seoul is not an authoritarian place. It's a crazy, wild, different place. It's a home to some of the world's biggest nightclubs. It's the home to Parasite, the movie that won the Oscar last year. It is the center of K-pop, which many of you on this call probably have a better knowledge than me. But by any measure, this is not something that you can just put down. It's simply because they organized themselves better. They knew what was happening. One final thing on it, it is definitely true that we are doing better when it comes to vaccines and issues like that. And we can come back and examine that. And there I would herald what the British government has done. But I think it is slightly the equivalent of scoring a goal in the last minute of a match that you've already lost 5-0. And I think that is, when we come back and look at the overall numbers, it will certainly help the fact that we've been much more efficient with the vaccines, but not in the overall picture.
Thank you, John. And now to your co-author, Adrian Wooldridge. Adrian.
Thank you for that. Well, we call this book The Wake-Up Call, but another possible title of it may have been The Turning Point. It may well be that when one looks back at the year 2020 and the year 2021, that this will be regarded not as the era that saw the end of populism or the end of Trump, but actually the era that saw the end of the Western era and the beginning of the Chinese era. We may be living through, at this moment, a great turning point in history in which China becomes the dominant power. And COVID may be remembered essentially as the canary in the coal mine, the moment where this change took place. And in order to understand just the significance of what's going on at the moment and the significance of the numbers that John was talking about, I think we have to go back to the 16th century in many ways. If you go back to the 16th century, China was the most powerful civilization in the world. It was the center of the world's most sophisticated civil service, with the Mandarin class selected from across a continent on the basis of the world's most sophisticated examinations. It had the world's biggest city in Peking. It had the world's most sophisticated system of irrigation with a national system of canals. And compared with that, Europe, and particularly Britain, were just blood-soaked irrelevances. You know, you had warring aristocracies, you had wars of religion, you had constant succession crises, because we hadn't really got the politics sorted out. We had very unstable political regimes. And what happens over the next four centuries is that Europe and then the United States pull ahead of China. And they do so for many complicated reasons, because they have the scientific revolution, because they have the development of the corporation and of capitalism. But right at the heart of why they pull ahead is the development of government. Europe invents the nation state in the 16th and 17th centuries. And we exemplify that in our book with Thomas Hobbes and his great book, Leviathan, published in 1651, which argues that for any state to function, it must have a monopoly of authority. That is indeed established. It then pulls ahead in the 18th and early 19th centuries with the liberal revolution, making government accountable, making government efficient, making government also competitive with the Northcote Trevelyan reforms, particularly in Britain, which again creates our own version of the Chinese Mandarin class selected by open examinations, getting rid of the notion that government is a parasite on the rest of the country. Then in the early 20th century, we developed the welfare state, the notion that government must guarantee certain inalienable rights to everybody, to pensions, to education, to subsidies in time of unemployment. So we have this incredibly inventive attitude to the state. And during this entire time, China ossifies. It doesn't reinvent the state. The state remains what it always has been. The examination questions that you're getting for your civil service exam are exactly the same in the early 20th century as they were in the 16th century, based on the Confucian classics. So we are a center of invention of government. And then suddenly something begins to change in the 1960s. What happens in the 1960s is that we really reach our peak and begin to ossify. And what happens in the most interesting thought about the state begins to happen in the Far East, beginning with Lee Kuan Yew in Singapore, who invents the notion of the state as something that is meritocratic and competitive, that is really austere, that creates a welfare state, but an austere welfare state, but also which uses the state as an engine of modernization. Not Thatcherite, very much a developmental state, with the state investing in state-owned enterprises in key areas of the economy. So this is a new version of what the state is about. It happens in Singapore. Well, who really cares about that? Great for Singapore. It becomes one of the wealthiest countries in the world, but it's 5 million people. It doesn't really matter. But now what's happening is something much more important than that, is that China is beginning to copy all of those various elements of the state, a highly competitive and successful educational system, a highly competitive notion, a successful notion of the developmental state, and they're creating a welfare state, something that didn't exist a decade or so ago, which is built on principles of austerity, kept small but efficient, is not allowed to sprawl in the way that it has in the West. So I would say that almost all of the most interesting thinking about the state since the 1960s has been going on in the East rather than the West. And suddenly we have this great test in the form of COVID. And what we discover from this test is that the West has actually become more decadent, more ossified, more uninventive, more rigid. And the East is actually, the Far East has actually got much further in terms of developing a new state. So I would say that this is an important moment, not because it is testing our ability to modernize, to rethink, to update the state, something which has been our competitive advantage for 400 years. We've failed, China has succeeded. So that's why this book, we hope, is a wake-up call. It's not too late, but we really have to begin to think very seriously about some of the fundamental building blocks of our state. Thank you.
Thank you, Adrian, and thank you, John. And now we have our own representative of the Mandarin class, Philip Rycroft. Philip, would you like to respond?
How do you respond to that? This is challenging stuff, very provocative. I read the book, enjoyed the book. And of course, there's a huge amount in it. And what I would say at the start, the policy prescriptions at the end of the book focused on America, but by and large, I'd agree with. I mean, there's a lot of common sense there. I think my issue is, in a sense, more with the diagnosis. I mean, I'm not a declinist by temperament, and just one sentence sort of caught my eye in the book. I don't know which one of you wrote it, but Western government has been crumbling for decades, overloaded with obligations, undersupplied with talent, and picked apart by special interests. You know, that's 30 years of my career that you've just sort of washed away there. You know, I've been working in a crumbling institution full of low-grade no-hopers who are incapable of learning. I know it's sort of a little bit cruel, and I paraphrase clearly there. And I think, of course, there is a different sort of narrative about the state of government in the West, what government in the West has achieved, how it's learned over time. You look a lot of the metrics pre-COVID in terms of health outcomes, wealth outcomes, educational outcomes, environmental outcomes. There has been, over those decades, undoubtedly huge amounts of progress across the West on average. Some of that, quite a lot of it in spite of the state, but some of it because of the state. You look at, for example, the expansion of higher education. From when I went to university, part of a essentially a privileged minority, now 40% plus of youngsters will go to university. There has been a lot of very positive change over that time. Now, of course, there are huge numbers of policy challenges and issues around it. I think my argument, in a sense, if you focus too much at the system level, it almost induces a sort of a state of catatonic gloom, because change in systems is really, really tough. But what I, as a policymaker, would prefer to do is to focus on the policy issues where there are problems and where we really do need to change things. And let me cut to the COVID chase on that, because I think that's a really good challenge. And let me focus on the UK. I think, first point, I don't think we fully understand yet why outcomes have been different across different parts of the world. Rates of COVID, for example, in Africa have been very low. And there is a deeper story to tell around all of that, which undoubtedly will emerge over time. It's also worth saying that some aspects of the British state have actually performed pretty well. We don't hear a lot about it because there has been undoubted success in the rollout of the furlough scheme, for example, the rapid expansion of universal credit in terms of the economic response has done pretty well. And you've already touched on the vaccine thing, where I think that combination of state, private sector and academia have been shown operating at its best. But the policy failures, just to sort of try and make my point, I would hone in on three things. First off, the nature of the centre of the British state is not designed to do things. And when it tried to do things on PPE procurement and test and trace, it failed pretty dismally. And that it says something about the nature of the very centre of the British system, around the Cabinet Office where I used to work, and Number 10. It is not good at doing stuff itself. Second thing, which I think is more of a systemic failure, very close to my heart, but the failure of the centre of Whitehall and Westminster to engage properly with local government, metro mayors and the devolved administrations. Contrast Australia, the national cabinet, contrast what happened in Germany, the bringing together of the entire strength of governance across the country. We failed dismally on that count, and I think that has had a very big impact on outcomes. But I think the biggest failure has been a failure of political courage at various stages through the pandemic, when decisions were required and decisions were delayed, and that has driven to a large extent the very poor outcomes that were faced. So some of this comes back to sort of more proximate issues about politics and where they are right now. So I could talk about that. There's a reason why our politics is in that state it is at the moment. But I would like to just to inject a little bit of confidence into the underlying strength of our system and of our democracy. And we have shown, as a society, it seems to me, immense resilience over the last 12 months under very, very trying circumstances. And I think we do have the capacity to learn from those mistakes, perhaps in a slightly plodding way, but I'm not quite as despairing as you are about our future as a polity and as a system of government.
You talk, Philip, about our capacity to learn from those mistakes. How good do you think Westminster or Whitehall are at learning from mistakes?
not as good inevitably as one would like the system to be. But, you know, if I look at my career, and that's sort of my best benchmark, it is sort of dotted with learning experiences and learning from others. When I was working in the business department, for example, on enterprise, where was one of my ports of call? Singapore, to go and try and understand how they organized their support for enterprise. When I was working on education in Scotland, going back a little bit further, what were the ports of call then for myself to some extent, and also for the minister I work with, New Zealand, Singapore again, and Finland. And I just tell you one little story about the visit to Singapore. I wasn't on, but the minister was on, sitting down with the Singapore Minister of Education, swapping notes on, you know, what's the big issue you're facing? And the minister I work for, Peter Peacock, saying, the big issue we're worrying about in Scottish schools at the moment is discipline, is to get kids to learn, to focus on learning. What's your issue? Well, we don't have any problem with discipline in Singaporean schools. Our problem is creativity, is to get the youngsters to think outside, is to be more creative, to be more challenging of what they're getting. This was, by the way, somebody called Mr. Hen. So Mr. Peacock, Mr. Hen, it's quite an interesting conversation. But you could see them coming from very different perspectives and actually, if you could have melded those two systems together, you would have got something quite interesting. So just a couple of instances of not just learning from mistakes, but learning from what others are doing around the world. And, you know, that's my experience, a couple of personal anecdotes, but I would not claim to be unique at all in that regard.
Now, you've mounted a robust defence. Let's come back to John and to Adrian and take the discussion forward. Which of you would like to go first?
Shall I have a go with firstly, I think we agree. I'll try and speak for both of us. Always a dangerous thing, but I think I agree with pretty much all Philip's policy things. I think especially the crisis between local and central. One of the points we make in the book is that Margaret Thatcher did to Britain a great disservice by kind of over-centralising that. Then that we remain massive fans of trying to get power back to places. I mentioned Seoul earlier. I mean, it had one reason why it did so well. It had a very good mayor who had the power to do things. He didn't necessarily end very well for him, but in all other respects, it was very good. I think the other point which we should have made, and it's lazy of us not to do it, and actually disrespectful as well, is that the thing which is really obvious about the public sector is an enormous number of people do very heroic and great jobs, in it, including Philip, but also very obviously people on the front line in the NHS and many other things. And you can still find, I think even if you take a jaundiced, cynical view like we do, you can still find unusual levels of sort of excellence inside the public sector. I think the thing which we would argue quite strongly on that, though, is that if certainly, you know, we look very hard at the numbers in America, and I think most of the numbers in Britain show the same thing, is that going back to since the 1960s, roughly, you know, back then a career in the public sector versus one in the private sector, which was one was more financially equal, at least, and it was much easier to attract more high flyers towards the public sector. That has definitely got harder. And it's also, I think, the point we make is that the elites and the public sector have divulged more, and they're obviously not unconnected, but there has been a sort of divergence between the two of them, spectacularly so when you look at the sort of private sector of the city or Silicon Valley in different places. And one of the arguments of the book when we come onto policy is we want to look for ways to reunite, I suppose, more talented, maybe overpaid people with the private sector. And one of our great sort of Singaporean lessons is that people like Philip should have been paid gigantically more than he was.
That we would say. For me.
But that alone, I thought we would win him over on. One small thing, which I think we should stress, which is intent by me to not disagree with what Adrian said, but to elaborate on it, is that there was a reason why we called this a wake-up call, is that the West has many problems. But, you know, overall, you look at democracies against authoritarian regimes and so on, there is a massive danger in this of people looking at China versus America and saying, look, the authoritarian regime's done better. They didn't. That just purely happens that the main authoritarian regime did a hell of a lot better than the main democracy by an unbelievable factor, even allowing for its rather hideous mistakes at the beginning. But the underlying point is still that you look at the strength of the democracies against the strength of China. If Joe Biden manages to unite the Europe and America again, if the democracies act as one, virtually every number from GDP to efficacy and all those sort of things is on their side. And most of the countries we celebrate in this book are democracies. So there is, you know, we still have the cards on our side, but what is definitely true is you cannot continue to be, especially in the Western bit of the democracies, as inefficient as we are. So that's the only, but those are the bits where I would sort of just elaborate.
Yeah, let me just say a few things. I've just got, just arrived in my inbox, is country rankings by something called the Lowy Institute in Australia, which has just done a ranking of people's response to COVID all around the world. I haven't had time to study, but I'm just rather struck by it. And what we have here is a whole bunch of countries. Vietnam is number two, Taiwan is number three, New Zealand number one, Thailand number four. Almost all of these countries are either Australasian countries or Far East countries in terms of their measured response, according to this quite lengthy report, which has obviously been, you know, they've obviously gone into great trouble to do this thing. Britain, the United Kingdom, comes down at number 66, which is really, I would have thought, a rather disappointing result for one of the world's most prominent and important countries. And America comes third from the bottom, you know, in the hundreds. So I think that we must understand, I think, first of all, that this is really rather a shocking set of results. 1,500 people per million dying in America, in Britain, 1,300 in America, very shocking set of results. And, you know, if we are accustomed to thinking of ourselves as amongst the best in the world, amongst the most sophisticated, well-governed societies in the world, but this great global test has suggested that we're not anywhere near as good as we think we are, and certainly not as good as we ought to be. So it is a really, really shocking set of results, which I'm sure will set us all thinking and reforming very hard. I think that's a shock to us. And I think we'd also, I think, whatever we think, in Britain, we have, I can see that we've had certainly incremental improvements and something sometimes more than incremental improvements. If you look at London schools and their successes over during the Blair period, that was a really very impressive example of what the public sector can do if it's well-directed and well-organized. But nevertheless, if we have been improving, we haven't been improving at anything like the sort of rate or with anything like the sort of ambition that Singapore has, Taiwan has, and indeed China has. And I think one of the great mistakes we make when we're thinking about China is we tend to think of China as an economic miracle and a business miracle, which it is. But also over the last 30 or 40 years, it's also been a government miracle. There's all sorts of appalling things about Chinese government, of course there are, but there's also a concerted attempt to build a welfare state, to revolutionize its educational capacity, to build state capacity. And they've become equal with us in important areas. So that's we're operating in a very, very much more competitive world than we used to be. But also two things that I'm sure we can all agree on, whatever our background or perspective. One is the disaster in the United States. And the United States is such a big part of what the West is about, 25% of global GDP and the rest of it. And I think it's a disaster that can't just be explained, just be blamed on Trump. It says something much more about their ailing state capacities than that. And secondly, that the architecture of the West, that the cooperation that should be at the heart of the West as an entity that is engaged in some sort of intensifying global competition with China, has really been remiss here. And again, that's partly Trump's fault. It's partly America's fault more broadly. But as we're seeing with this lamentable argument about the vaccines with the European Union. The European Union has really not had its finest hour with what's going on at the moment. So I think both in terms of state capacity nationally in some countries, including our own, and the West's capacity to coordinate and respond to a massive challenge, we have some very worrying things going on here.
I'm glad you've broadened it out beyond just the UK, because the book is a powerful critique of Western governments more generally, in particular the US. But amongst Western governments, are there any exceptions to this sad litany of general failure? And if so, which are they and why?
Well, from my Lowy Institute, I mean, it must be said it's an Australian outfit, but there are New Zealand, Australia, I mean, the countries sitting out there. And it's quite interesting that these countries, that New Zealand has clearly done extremely well. They basically have no COVID. I think I saw a news report about a party of 20,000 people listening to pop music, than which I can think of nothing worse myself, went on. And it's interesting that these successful countries are sitting there in the middle of Asia, in East Asia. It's almost as though they understand that they're in a competitive world. They can see what's going on in Singapore. They can see what's going on in Taiwan and the rest of it. And they're almost sort of improving because they know that it's a tough environment that they're in. But yeah, definitely New Zealand and Australia.
I mentioned sort of Greece, you could look at, which I think has done unexpectedly well, just because it focused on having a really clear message. I mean, one interesting thing about Greece is that they had this terrible thing of having a healthcare system which had been very badly hit. And so they went quickly to lockdown. Yep. And they've gone for very, very simple messages. Along, they worked out fairly early on that your chances of getting the disease by outside was smaller than inside. So they switched to very quickly messages. Everyone had to wear masks inside, indoor buildings immediately, those sort of things. Germany for a while looked quite good. It has to be said that, you know, the and especially on the stuff Philip mentioned early on, they made a decision which was sadly, and this is an example of where we did not do well, this decision to, they use private sector pharmacies and things like that to start doing testing. So there are, you know, there are people who've done well. Some of the Nordics have been okay. But for us, I think it, you know, trying to, it's more a case of us sitting and looking and thinking we want to compare ourselves against the best rather than just against the ones who did okay. And at this precise moment, again, we should be clear, Britain and America look slightly better. There is, needless to say, far better than the Lowy thing. There is a brilliant on the Bloomberg website. There is a resilience tracker where Britain and America actually appear slightly higher, still useless, but higher than on the Lowy one, partly because we gave higher marks to preparing vaccines, where both Britain and America have done well.
On the self-regulation front, I think it is also important to note that we have done extremely well in developing, purchasing and distributing the vaccines. We've been amongst the best in the world. Britain has, I think, distributed more than 5 million. Only Israel, I think, is doing better. I mean, that's a remarkable turnaround. It does point to the ability of the system to learn. And that's a remarkable thing. You know, I think by common consent, Boris Johnson would be regarded as somebody who got off to a slow start in this. he didn't go to the first five COVID meetings. Britain floundered at first. But this vaccine, purchasing in particular, has been a remarkable example, not just of central government learning, but also of the ability to cooperate with the private sector, or to, should I say, bring in private sector abilities in a crisis, just as we've done with PPE. And we shouldn't, you know, this is a remarkable turnaround. We're doing much significantly better than countries that were regarded as exemplars in Europe. And I think we're among the best in the world. So we should acknowledge that.
Can I do a quick counterfactual? If we go back almost a year, and if at the first sort of signs of this emerging, this government had said, right, this is serious. The only way we're going to deal with this is by essentially following what the Chinese had already done in Wuhan, very strict lockdown, shutting the borders, And by the way, despite all the vaporings of the Daily Telegraph and all the rest of it, you're going to stay locked down until we've got on top of this thing. The results would look very, very different, very different now. We wouldn't have got away with it. But what my argument a little bit is that is a moment in time, a decision, and I can have every sympathy for the politicians who were confronted with that decision. Hugely difficult, all the pressures on them. But that's the nature of political leadership. That's why you're going in. If you mess up, however difficult it is, you deserve the blame for that. But if they'd had the courage, and it was courage in the sense that was required, to go down that track at that time, it's almost in a single moment of time, getting that decision of right would have been not yes. quite transformational, but would have made a huge difference.
No, we wasted a vital week.
And then repeated that mistake again, you know, at the end of the
spring.
But could just one point where, I mean, I don't want to agree with everything you say, clearly, because I'm not meant to, but one thing where it would be, I think I do agree with you. I think I've experienced this in different guises, and indeed talked to Robert about it in different guises through the course of my career. The seriousness with which we think about government is not where, in my view, where it ought to be. And that's not just about, it's not so much the civil service itself, it's not just about the political class, but it's also the wider wraparound of that. The difficulty we have of contemplating serious reform of our constitutional or other arrangements in this country, I think is very damaging. And let me just give you one example, but it's one that stands out, that we still have a second chamber in this country where 90% of the folk in it are there by virtue of their great, 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 whatever, grandfathers bashing somebody over the head at the appropriate moment, is just extraordinary. And if you think at all the big reform moments in British history, 1832, through the Chartists, through the suffragettes and beyond, you have an upwelling of opinion outside of Parliament to put the pressure on the politicians to think about the nature of the system of governance. And I have to say, for somebody who's worked on constitution devolution issues, the understanding of the way that we're governed, how that works, is not where it ought to be. And it does frustrate me immensely that there isn't the seriousness of discourse about our system of governance beyond the political class. And so if your book prompts that sort of discussion a bit more, it will be doing a very good thing.
We mustn't talk any more about COVID, but Philip's raised a really interesting new dimension, which apart from what you say in the book about the importance of regional and local government and much better coordination between the different levels of government, there's a separate question which you might call nation building, or, you know, keeping the nation together, given the very serious divisions in the US and the very big divisions now in the UK and the real risks of a possible fracture of the union. It's not something I think I remember that you addressed in your book, so it's a slightly curveball question to throw at you. But in terms of those matters of state building, keeping the nation together, are there lessons to be learned from countries like China or South Korea? Those are very big countries.
Well, I wouldn't want to learn a lesson from China in keeping the state together, because I think they do it rather with the jack.
Scotland become like the Uyghurs is slightly afraid.
Yes, quite. but I think that, you know, if you look at the at state disintegration, it does tend to happen when people lose faith in their government, either because they lose faith in their government representing their collective interests, or faith in the government as being able to deliver the services that they want. So our programme, which would say that we need to take government seriously, to learn from the best that's going on in the world, and to rebuild government sometimes from the ground up in order to make it more efficient, I think would address a lot of these issues, both of disillusionment with central government and of regional separatism. Because if you know, Scotland is separating, is trying, quite likely in my opinion at the moment, to separate from the rest of UK for many reasons, but a lot of it is to do with efficiency. And they just don't think that the UK makes sense as an efficiency delivering mechanism. Scotland voted in 2014 to stay in the UK because they thought on the whole they were better off in Britain. And now they feel in general they wouldn't be better off because of two things, because of Brexit, which they think was a mistake in practical terms, a mistake in practical terms, and because of COVID, because they think that the Scottish government has been more successful, significantly more successful than the London government in delivering, in dealing with COVID. So I think if you have a better government practically, you do begin to calm some of these, I'm almost tempted to say insurrectionary sentiments, but that would be the wrong word, these separatists, sentiments. I also think there's a sense in which people have been the not the political class, the educated class in the country has been sort of denigrating government. Or people have said we don't need to go into government in the way we used to. We need to go in the private sector. That's where all the action is. You know, it's almost as though if you go into the civil service, you're going against the trend within your peer group. And I think that's something that's profoundly worrying. We do need the best people to continue to go into government. And also one of the things we recommend in this book is a reintroduction of national service, by which we don't mean military national service of the Israeli variety. What we mean is military national service if you want it, but basically going to work for the public sector for a period, because we think there's now a separation between people and government, which is a very, very dangerous one. We need people to collectively be more connected with their government than they have come to be in the last few decades.
Can I add one thing on that? Just two things. One, I very much agree with it, and it partly answered Philip's last point about, I think Margaret Thatcher played a bad role in this, in the sense of denigrating government, and it making it certainly fashionable on part of the right in Britain. It's far less extreme than America, that the only answer to everything is you know, smaller, you know, get rid of government. The less government, the better. It's not as fundamentalist in the Conservative Party as it is in the Republican Party, but that was an unfortunate bit. I was actually going to be optimistic, strangely, on three different grounds from a British point of view, and this may be insane, but at least it's worth putting forward. The first is you look at the history of government. Obviously, we're from Britain, so we look at it. But it's amazing what a role this place has played. You know, we went back to Hobbes and John Stuart Mill. You know, virtually all the big revolutions in government have come around here. You could argue Thatcherism was one of the last great revolutions, and that began here. Britain seems to be unusually good at this stuff. I would say that there's also a degree of, there was possibilities of unity. I think the Dominic Cummings thing, the level to which that split government from the people, I think was extremely unfortunate over what he did. But the last point I would make is that I think your very argument, Robert, is an argument why Britain may have to do something. If you have two things, you have the economic challenge of Brexit, which is real. And then secondly, on top of it, you have this issue about the union and whether it works and the danger of coming apart. You know, if you were in Thomas Hobbes' era, if you were a monarch who lost control of his state, you were in a lot of trouble rather quickly. You know, it would take, you know, that will become a very enormous threat, I think, to the Conservative Party, not the Unionist Party. And the lesson of governmental reform is it comes about in quite a lot in government and crisis, and especially in competition. And in America, has this huge advantage now that it has this prompt of China to say that if America finally has a competitor, that should wake it up. Britain has a kind of crisis, which you might argue, have managed to create ourselves on several different levels. That will wake us up. And I think we tend to be about the right kind of size for these revolutions. And I never forget the fact that in the 1970s, very few people really saw what Thatcher was doing. And Thatcher did do at least some of the things that Philip pointed out, that Britain is good things. Some good things came from Thatcher. I don't want to write her off completely, but she caused some bad things. But underlying it, I would say that Britain is ripe for a revolution, perhaps more than a kind of reform of government, perhaps more than any other country for those reasons.
We've touched now, which is very helpful, on the policy prescriptions in the last two chapters of your book, and you've mentioned several of them. Before we open it up to Q&A, are there any other important policy prescriptions that you'd like to mention?
Well, we in this book create this, we use a sort of device. We create this figure we call Bill Lincoln, who is a sort of imaginary president, but he is compounded of two people. One is William Gladstone, and one is Abraham Lincoln, the two great liberal reformers of the middle of the 19th century. And we give him carte blanche to clean up American government. And we say that he can do anything he wants, just so long as he's taking examples of things that actually work somewhere in the world. So he can't sort of build a new civilization on the moon or something like that. He has to borrow from practical things that are going on. And if you transplant this figure from the White House to Downing Street, I think you get an interesting set of things. And what we would basically argue is that we have a capacity to simplify government, to focus government, and to use much more modern technology to disperse modern technology right the way through the governmental system to make it more lean, but also more up to date. Now, all of these things have been applied in little bits of government, but I think that what we need to do is to make it pervasive, recruit a lot more of the sort of people that Google is recruiting, which will entail, I think, much more flexible salary systems and working systems. And also really, I think, need to start, as Philip was saying earlier, on the very heart of government. Now, I don't want to go all Dominic Cummings on everybody, but there is a sort of sense that there is a very antiquated heart to government. There's a way of doing things which is very tradition-bound, and also would not be the sort of thing that a modern private company would look to. I think what Cummings was saying when he said you need to have real-time data, you need to sort of deal with this issue of putting a bunch of papers in the minister's box every night, probably to drown him in papers. You need to have a much more coordinated, internet-ready, information-savvy heart of this machine.
Philip, last question to you before we open it up.
One sort of slight provocation back. And I ran a department where the median age was 29. So that I used to say to them that most of you in this room weren't born when I joined the civil service. But and after this was a department for exits in the EU, pretty challenging gig for everybody. I have to say, and there may be one or two of them on this call, but there may be folk aspiring to go into it, these were brilliant people. And they were better educated, they had more savoir-faire, more tools at their disposal from their learning than I had when I went in the civil service 30 years before them. I would have found it difficult to compete with them as my younger self. So there's a wee bit of hope in that. But I just wanted to come back on one policy point, which I think is really, really important for particularly the British and the American experience. And that is the relative failure to deal with the economic and social inequality that has come from the economic dislocation of technology-driven change, the loss of manufacturing jobs, all the rest of it over the last 20, 30 years. And I think there's a great explanatory power there for why the populist sentiment in the US and the UK has been greater than elsewhere.
Yeah,
I suspect there's also something in there why COVID outcomes have been worse because of that concentration of deprivation and so on. And I was sort of interested because in your policy prescriptions, you didn't sort of go into that territory so much. But I would have thought that in anybody looking at the state of the UK or the US, that surely has to be very, very high up your list of things to sort out to try and re-knit a social contract which is both economic, it's social, it's cultural, but it's political as well. And I think that is a failure of certainly UK governments over the last 20, 30 years to really get a grip on that. But I'd be interested in your thoughts on that.
hold your thoughts if you would, because I think it's time that we did invite the audience to fire their questions at us. So Abby, over to you. Would you like to collect the first round of questions?
Yeah, sure. So we'll start with three. I'm going to call Sanjeev, Wei, and Claudio. So you should all be able to speak.
So should we go first? Yes.
Sorry, can you hear me?
We can.
Okay. Hi. My question is with regards to what Mr. Rycroft said in the beginning, where the British state is not designed to do things and or specifically to address, well, very singular tasks like getting enough PPE for the NHS, etc. So my question is, then what then is the British state designed for?
Okay, hold that if you would, Philip. And shall we go next to Sanjeev? No, we're not hearing. So, Abby, would you like to read out his question?
Yeah, his question is, how much of the failure of governance in the Western democracies relates to the failings of checks and balances on centralized power?
Very good question, thank you. And then thirdly, from my colleague at UCL, Claudio, Professor Araeli.
Oh, welcome. Hello. Thank you. Hello. If the explanation lies in the efficiency of governance mechanisms, you stressed this is a historical process of ossification of the state, how come the Britain has been and still is inefficient at handling the spread of the virus and efficient at rolling out the vaccine? It's the same government, after all. I think, as Philip Rycroft said, perhaps we should look at wrong and correct policy choices and a more granular explanation.
Very good. John, would you like to go first?
Yes, why should I take, I briefly thought it said Claudio Ranieri, which made me fantastic for aesthetic reasons to do with Leicester City. I think the answer, the way to look at it is to look at the whole. Governments tend to be good at some things and others, and you're right about the granular thing. But I think if you don't make big generalizations about what's happened, and you don't try and draw lessons about how good it is. You're absolutely right. Yeah, Britain has been good at the virus, vaccines. Germany's been lousy at vaccines. Britain and the EU has not been great. But Britain was lousy about protecting its citizens beforehand. And that's one reason why we return to that deaths per million thing, because that is probably in the end the kind of purest equivalent. And you can find people, you can make excuses for people, you can give reasons. I think, you know, Italy, for instance, I think it's completely fair to say that they more than any other European country was blindsided by the virus when it first started. I don't think we have that excuse whatsoever. Yes. But in this you can, people, Philip's absolutely right, and we've all sort of said bits of this, is that you need to look at individual mistakes about why there wasn't enough PPE, why the preparations for other pandemics did not work well. But there is a sort of point at which you get so many things wrong, you have to ask the question about whether you need a real overhaul. And there is, you know, one reason why the vaccine thing did involve a lot more private sector. We have a very good, you know, big pharma may not be very popular, but it's one of the things we have in this country. The thing which really strikes you about the West, we quote a figure who runs a large, one of the world's largest companies, who I happen to talk to. He was pretty much the same as Boris Johnson, or could have been the same. He runs a gigantic company. This disease broke out in Germany, in China. And for reasons, I think some of you may have seen a program on the BBC the other night, you know, the Chinese did hide it. They did a lot of bad things around that time. And he, like many other people, thought this was just a Chinese thing that was not that communicable to humans. He has a lot of facilities in China, is what I would describe. And then his next thing was, he thought, well, this is just a China thing. It's more like SARS. It's not going to go particularly wide. Maybe it's something in Asia. I'll start dealing it there. By the end of February, you know, the Adrian's current employer, you have a cover of The Economist that says COVID goes global. it's still another month before Boris does anything. The interesting thing about this man who runs a company is that by that time he has realized something has happened, and he is running around like an idiot, trying to, he's talking to these countries in East Asia which seem to know what to do, and he is utterly horrified that when he goes back to America and he tries to talk to his regulators, his local government people there, they have no interest in this. They're not even beginning to react in the same way. And so I think at that point you have to ask the serious question, is government as responsive? Yes, in these cases, again, it's yet another thing where people will point out the Asians had the advantage of having gone through this. That matters up to a certain extent. It does not explain anything. It's the liveliness. It's the fact of thinking, why is things not working? We have to change. You look at the stuff which on the whole, Jeremy Hunt has been saying throughout this, he hasn't got everything right. But by most people think he's just simply been someone who knows something reasonably about healthcare, making points about what you could have done. It's not, you're right about that. Every single bit you can argue, well, somebody did this well, that bit badly. But the overall picture, you know, again, go back to my Ranieri joke, go back to football. The basic thing is we lost. We have done worse than pretty much everywhere. Belgium's, you know. Yes, we've done well on vaccines. So look at the whole thing and you have to react to these things. It's as stupid to make a kind of Brexiteer remark, which I'm not, but to make the mark, it's as stupid as the EU basically doing absolutely nothing after Britain leaves. 20% of your world has just disappeared. You would expect the European Union to come up with some kind of structural changes, do whatever. They've done virtually nothing. And we mustn't let kind of COVID be the same with us. You know, Britain's reaction or America's reaction to this is just to say, well, we got some things right, some things wrong, and it was all pretty much the same. We didn't. We were dramatically outperformed by people. And that's the reason why we wrote the book, is just to sort of tell people. And I think in Britain, actually, that message is resounding perhaps slightly more than it is in America, where everyone tends to either think it was Trump's fault or that Biden will save them, when, you know, America messed up because it has a healthcare system which is designed for the rich and the old. And very quickly on that, you know, one of our solutions to the equality thing in America, at least, was to say they need universal. Yeah. Sorry, anyway, too long an answer, and I apologize.
No, that was all great. Adrian, could you address Sanjeev's question? The second one was about, is this down to a failure of checks and balances?
The answer to that is no. I mean, I think that the great virtue of checks and balances is they prevent people from doing the wrong things by slowing the process of change slowing the political process down. And I think that's a remarkable and wonderful thing. But I think there are certain times, such as a crisis, when the last thing you want is to be slowed down. I think checks and balances are great to stop the defects of democracy or majorities imposing their will on minorities, or tyrants hijacking the system. But where they don't really work very well is when you have a sudden crisis from outside. And what people tend to do when they have a sudden crisis from outside is actually get round these checks and balances. You know, if you're attacked in a war, you know, the prime minister takes central power. And I think, again, in this case, I don't think checks and balances are the real thing. What I think we should have done, at the very beginning of this process, is I think there was an incredible failure of imagination in cabinet government. I think that the government should have recognized from the very first, there is no game in town other than COVID. This is such a central threat to our lives that we have to reorganize everything around COVID. I think they should have reorganized the cabinet. They should have created a second cabinet focused purely on COVID. And they should have made a very clear distinction between sort of operational things and presentational things. So they should have brought in more people who are entirely focused on getting PPE sorted out. Instead, you had people like poor old Matt Hancock dealing with presentation, dealing with organizing PPE, dealing with running the National Health Service. You know, he had very much too much on his plate. At the same time, you had lots of people in cabinet who didn't seem to have very much to do. I think we should, a company would have said, this is the only business in town. We have to have complete reorganization. We tried to muddle through with a cabinet government which didn't have the right people in it, didn't have the right division of responsibilities, and slowed the whole response process down. So I get rid of those sorts of checks and balances and say, you know, we have the equivalent of a war cabinet.
Philip, you've worked in cabinet office. Is that in any way realistic, what Adrian's just been saying?
It is, because it happened. I mean, it happened in 1914, it happened in 1915, yeah. Whatever. You know, the state responds in a time of crisis. It can clearly be done. It didn't happen this time around. I think that is going to be part of the of what is looked at here. Just two quick points in response to the question. On the checks and balances, I broadly agree in a time of crisis, you need to get on with it. But there is a deeper point there, which is about the way, this is a UK point again, but there are sort of an elective dictatorship. And particularly given first past the post, the decline of mass membership of political parties has pushed political debate into the sort of extremes, and you get this sort of toxic concentration on either side of the political spectrum, which makes measured consensual thought about how you reform the state to improve it really rather difficult. Contrast other countries, take Finland as an example, where the nature of the almost obliges people ultimately to work together, to reach agreement in order to make the changes necessary. Think about the way that the Finns responded to the complete collapse of their economy after the fall of the, you know, when the Soviet Union collapsed and so on. A great example of a democratic system working out how to change in the face for them of what was an existential crisis. And I think, again, with Robert's hat on, bring the constitution back in here. I think we need to think about that. But just on the first question about the cabinet office and the way that operates, my point was very much about the center of the British state, the center. And you know, what does it do if it doesn't do stuff? It does presentation. That's its obsession. The number 10 nexus supported by the cabinet office, it revolves around presenting government policy and political positions. It is not designed to make real stuff happen on the ground. And you know, when wise politicians recognize that for the Olympics, for example, get that outsourced, create a body that can take that forward. And that, I absolutely agree, should have been the more of the instinct in this crisis to think about how do you get other folk engaged in a way that gives them a clear line of sight and what they have to do. Interestingly, on vaccine rollout, this story is not, I haven't read much about this or anything about it yet, but who's in charge of rollout? It's not actually the centre, it's Sir Simon Stevens. It's the NHS that is running the rollout. And so where you're there, you're engaging what is an extraordinarily powerful, in many ways, organisation with reach across the country. You're not dependent on very few decision makers at the centre. So I think, and again, I would say that this is something about the attitude of government. We know best, this is what we're going to do. And they did not pull the resource in, certainly at the start, from around the country, and instead stuck in that sort of mode of, we know what we're doing, and we're going to focus mainly on the presentational stuff. Yeah.
Now, time for another round. And Abid, just tell us, how many questions you've got queued. Are we going to have just one more round, or is there room for two more rounds?
If we could do two more, that would be good.
Well, I'll just ask the panelists. Do you mind if we go on for 10 minutes more?
Sure.
Very good. So quick answers, if you would, to the next two rounds then. So Abby, yes, second round.
So I'm going to call Sam Dixon, Arthur and Anna.
Very good. Sam, would you like to put your question?
Yes. Hi, everyone. I just wanted to ask, in what context is it better for the government to use the private sector than the civil service?
Very good. And then Arthur?
Sorry, I was just trying to find my question. Thank you for the talk. In the context of talking about government reform, Where do you think government reform will come from? I mean, we spoke about these moments. Well, I didn't speak about them, but you guys did, such as the Great Reform Acts, which are quite poignant in political history. And there was immense public pressure But at the same time, I don't feel like there is that conversation in the public on issues like this today. So, yeah, okay. Where will the change?
Where's the, pressure to make the turning point? And thirdly, Anna Teresa, could you ask your question?
All right, thank you for having me. So my question is, I know from the Singaporean model that the leaders there are able to do to take unpopular decisions and have long-term strategies just because the government there is so stable. So in Western democracies, we often see, for example, Obama beginning a healthcare reform and then Trump just, well, going into the other direction. And I think we can assume that COVID-19 would have turned out differently with another leader. So how do you think Western democracies can maintain some kind of more of a balance and more of a, some kind of stable development towards certain goals when you have so much polarization between different political parties?
Thank you. Let's take our panelists in reverse order this time. So Philip, would you like to go first, and then Adrian, and then John?
And there are three extraordinarily broad-ranging questions. I'll do my best.
You don't have to answer them all.
Yes, I know. Well, private sector versus civil service, I think, and there is no simple algorithm for that. I mean, obviously, the government engages the private sector in all sorts of ventures and spends, indeed, probably the majority of its money via the private sector in one way, certainly in infrastructure development and so on. I think there is an argument for a greater engagement of the private sector in many ways. And it's a great, one of the great political issues in British politics is the health service and, you know, people's worry about nationalisation of the health service. In fact, an awful lot of healthcare is delivered through the private sector. And this is, just to sort of tie it into the third question, This seems to me where looking, understanding how a system can to think about change in a way that builds a consensus so that change can be sustained over time. You're absolutely right. The chopping and changing is really destabilizing. You look at regional policy, for example, particularly for England, it changes with every government. So you never get that consistency of purpose over time. So it does argue in my book to think about the way in which we manage our politics and to put more emphasis and onus on working to achieve, have the debate, but achieve consensual agreement on a way forward that gives you then the sustaining of a reform momentum over time. Really difficult to do in our system. That's why I would argue that you need to look quite fundamentally at the way that we elect our politicians.
Adrian?
Well, I'm stuck on this point about one of the things that we've had in the, I'm stuck on the point about stability and continuity, because one of the things we have as a sort of endemic part of our system, of the democratic system, is that you don't have the sort of stability and continuity that Singapore has had. And that's both a good thing and a bad thing. It's a good thing because we're responsive to the people, we're responsive to discontent, and we're capable of changing direction, as Mrs. Thatcher changed direction. If discontent with the old system builds up to a sufficient level, you can go off in a new direction. And in 1979, we certainly did that. But one of the really complicating factors with COVID is that the countries that have dealt particularly badly with COVID, I think, given one's expectations, Britain and the United States, are both exemplars of populism and polarization. They both saw a concerted revolt against the system and a sense that we had to change the system fundamentally. We had that with Brexit and America had that with Trump. So the political class was divided, was defensive, and was not really focusing on the issue of some pandemic that might emerge from nowhere. You know, it was sort of they had lots of things on their mind other than that, and that lack of stability and that degree of polarization was a very distracting thing. Now I think we're less polarized now than we were, but we're still very distractible, and I get the sense that all of the energy and thinking of the political class is rapidly shifting towards Scotland, and that will become the issue people obsess about. And the boring things like how you make government work and how you reform the structure of the cabinet, all of those sort of things will be quickly pushed to the bottom of the pile. And I think one of the things we really wanted to do with this book is to say, maybe you cannot stop focusing on government. It may sound boring, but it's the difference between life and death. It's incredibly important, and you have to focus on it. So, you know, one reason we got this book out as quickly as we did, and we've tried to take a very active part in the debate, is to say, do not get distracted by bright, colourful things. Focus on re-engineering government.
John.
I'll take the middle question, which I don't think either my colleagues did, but I completely agree with everything pretty much they've said on the other two. Just on this issue about what prompts reform, in general, again, very big generalizations, but big governmental reform tends to happen when there are three things happening: when there's new technology, when there's new ideas, and when there's some kind of threat or crisis as well. And the sort of new technology, I think by any means that you look at the change, Philip is dead right to point out the public sector has changed in some ways, but you look at the changes in the corporate world over the past 20, 30 years, you just look at the list of names, which are the big names now, and every conceivable way, we have changed the private sector in ways that we never dreamt possible 20, 30 years ago. And there is technology there to be used, and the public sector on the whole has not been always great at using it. I think in terms of new ideas, part of the aim of our book is to tell people to start thinking. I mean, you could argue that very first question about, which bits should the civil service do and which bit the private sector do. You could almost reverse it and say which bits should not be done by the private sector, but at the very least start asking fundamental questions about which bits do work. Just say one thing about the last bit, competition. And crisis, I would never underestimate that on two examples. One, when we look at the welfare state, which we say is the last big revolution that happened, there are two reasons why we ended up with a welfare state. One was an admirable liberal thing where people sat there and thought that there was a need to look after the poor of the country. There was a need to create education, pensions, all these things. But the bigger thing, arguably, a sort of dirty secret of it, was competition. You know, 100 years ago, we were terrified of Germany. So people like Winston Churchill, who frankly did not give a great deal of attention to what was happening to working class children, they were terrified by the idea that we would no longer have good enough soldiers to be able to fight against Germany. That's what pushed conservatives to back this. You look at America now, the main chance of reform, I think, comes from that ability to fight, that America thinks that it's being left behind by China. That tends to wake countries up. What the revolutions Adrian described earlier, it may not be sort of fashionable to say it was wonderful that the British were competing with the French and the Spanish, but it was an existential thing. You know, you either improved your government or somebody else took it over. And I think that type of thing is that there is a point in that. So new ideas, new technology, plus this sort of competition or a threat, and plagues throughout history have been a reason for countries either to get it together or not.
Now, we've given ourselves 5 minutes of extra time, so it's just time for one last round. Abby, three more questions, please.
I've just got two questions.
Two questions, very good.
I'm going to ask Dan to ask his, and then I'm going to read Tamlin's on her.
Very good.
Cheers. Have the best achievers in COVID response faced protest against the regulations imposed on them?
Did everyone catch that?
Sorry, I didn't know.
Yes, could you say it again, Abby?
Yeah. Have the best achievers in COVID response faced protests against the regulations imposed on them?
Have they faced protests?
Yeah.
Right, against the regulations. And Dan, could we have your question?
My question is about the UK public perception of the state post-COVID. Do you think that large swathes of the public will now think that the government is essentially an entity which is incapable of doing anything competently?
Very good. So quick responses, please, just to these last two questions. Let's take John and then Adrian and then Philip.
Well, on the second one, one hopes, I'll take the second one just to make it
very short. Good.
I think that, yes, there will be people who will be fed up with the government. I think there's probably likely to be a bigger portion of people who are going to call on the government to do more things. People are going to say, we need to have even more plentiful provision of care. And I think, at least from our point of view, we would ask the question, you know, did that, was the size of the government such as it is, was that a help? I mean, I paid tribute to the people in the NHS, many of whom are far braver than me, but, you know, that is the single biggest organization in Western Europe, depending on how you measure it, fifth biggest, fourth biggest in the world by any measure. So we had a bigger organization than anybody else, and yet we have ended up with worse numbers overall. Notwithstanding, I agree completely with Philip, the wonderful issues, the wonderful things that the NHS has done on vaccines. So, I mean, there is a reason, I think, to look and really try and work out where government works, where it's effective. And that is what those people in the 19th century did. You know, Gladstone was committed to two things really clearly. Number one, help the poor, push the poor forward. Number two, spend as little money doing that as possible, because he thought that the money belonged to the people, did not belong to the government.
Adrian, could you answer the question about protests and whether there have been any?
I haven't been around the entire world looking at protests. I think I just don't know what exactly the details are in New Zealand, for example. But I think it's certainly the case that many, many countries which have had very successful responses have had, you know, serious protests. I would regard Germany's initial response as very successful. And they've had, you know, the Alternative for Deutschland or aligned groups have been protesting extremely vigorously. So I think yes, there are protests. And I think it's quite astonishing if you look not just at physical protests, but sort of intellectual protests right across Europe. About 20% of people say that they won't take the vaccine. They don't believe in the vaccine. You know, conspiracy theories, opposition, you know, fundamental opposition to the state is surprisingly widespread. The country, of course, where there haven't been massive street protests against lockdowns is China. But the reason for that is too obvious even to mention.
Just a really quick thing on that. I think it is possible that one of the long-term repercussions of this is that inside China is that the middle classes of China, notwithstanding the huge success they've had, they had to take some level of beyond draconian levels, which I think will have an effect. So there'll be a factor there. It's the same bits you see in WeChat and people like that, people getting cross about schools that don't work, because the Chinese state is not perfect. And any element of privilege in it, people are getting cross about. So there is a sort of, there will maybe not protest, but there is anger there, I think, in some parts of it, notwithstanding the generally better performance. Sorry, Philip.
Philip, the last word.
Very briefly, I think in terms of government reputation, and the public has, in this country, been remarkably forgiving, actually, of the government so far. You look at the opinion polls and the rest of it. I'm absolutely with Adrian and John on hoping actually that this moment does not pass without an engagement in a very serious debate about what's gone wrong with this, which can focus on some of the specific policy things that I pointed out, but does ask those bigger questions as well. What does this show about ourselves as a society, our government system, and can we course correct? And that will require a seriousness of political debate, Brexit debate notwithstanding, that I don't think we've had for many years in this country. A final point, just to pick up on the competition thing, and maybe this is a slightly more optimistic outlook for the West, but if you go back to the 50s, the real concern in the US and elsewhere about the competition from Russia, or Soviet Union as it was then, Sputnik and all the rest of it, that did prompt a real angst about the relative failure of the West, the space program in the US and so on, but that sense of renewal in competition, and maybe this combination of the rise of China, the failures over COVID will prompt such a moment again. I will end on a point of agreement. I absolutely agree. It's about time that we put some serious thought into this. So I enjoyed the book and I do recommend anybody who's not read it should read it.
Well, thank you, all three of you. Before formally I thank you, I must just give a trailer for next week's seminar, which is very topical given tonight's discussion. It's about China and Taiwan. And we've got two Chinese experts and one Taiwanese discussing to what extent China's growing might is a threat to Taiwan's independence. And that's at the same time next Thursday at 6 p.m. Tonight, we've been discussing this book, The Wake Up Call. And if you've enjoyed the discussion, go out and buy the book. We've had another little plug from John for the Bloomberg Tracker as the best source of information about all the different countries in the world and their effectiveness, in particular in combating the coronavirus epidemic.